Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, can hear you.
Fantastic. We are recording. My name is Alex Bice. I am here with Robert Schimpf. The date is August 4th, 2020. The time is 10:33 a.m. I'm located in Boston, Massachusetts. Robert, where are you located?
Boston, Massachusetts.
Great. I want to briefly review the informed consent and deed of gift document. This interview is for the COVID-19 Oral History Project, which is associated with the Journal of the Plague Year, a COVID-19 archive. The COVID-19 Oral History Project is a rapid response oral history focused on archiving the lived experiences of the COVID-19 epidemic. We've designed this project so that professional researchers and the broader public can create and upload their oral history to our open access and open source database. This study will help us collect narratives and understandings about COVID-19, as well as help us better understand the impacts of the pandemic over time. The recordings, demographic information, and the verbatim transcripts will be deposited in the Journal of the Plague Year, COVID-19 Archive, and the Indiana University Library System for the use of researchers and the general public. Do you have any questions about the project I can answer?
I do not, no. It seems like a great venture.
Great. Taking part in this study is voluntary. You may choose not to take part, or you may leave the study at any time. Leaving the study will not result in any penalty or loss of benefits to which you are entitled. Your decision whether or not to participate in the study will not affect your current or future relations with Indiana University, IUPUI, or the IUPUI Arts and Humanities Institute. Participating in this project means that your interviews will be transcribed in digital video and or audio format. The recordings and possible transcriptions of my interviews, copies of any supplementary documents or additional photos that you wish to share. The informed consent and deed of gift document may be deposited in the Journal of the Plague Year, a COVID-19 archive, and the Indiana University Library System, and will be available to both researchers and the general public. Your name and other means of identification will not be confidential. Do you have any questions?
I do not.
Fantastic. Great. So we are good to get started. So just to start out, could you talk a little bit about your background and your current position, the organization you work with, and what your job entails?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Robert Schimpf. I am 31 years old. I currently live in Boston, Massachusetts, kind of the suburb of, or not suburb, but neighborhood of Brighton with my wife, Megan LeBaron. I am originally from the Midwest, so I grew up on a farm in central Illinois, Sparland, Illinois, so not too far from Bloomington and Indiana University. I lived there through my entire youth, and then went to Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for my undergraduate degrees in broadcast and electronic communications and history. Then following my graduation at Marquette University, I moved out to Boston in 2011 and recently completed, I guess a couple of years ago now, my PhD in American history at Boston University. So since I've been in Boston, I was concurrently working on my dissertation while also working in public history, primarily at Adams National Historical Park. And upon completion of my degree, I was able to secure the position that I'm currently in, which is the Research and Adult Program Director for the Paul Revere Memorial Association. So I started that position in literally at the start of 2019, so January 2nd, 2019. So I've been in that position for about a year and a half now. I conduct various research projects and needs for the Paul Revere Memorial Association, which is primarily and initially consisted of the Paul Revere House itself, but now two other historic structures. We continue to produce original content through several medium, both digitally and in print, on Paul Revere, the house, the north end of Boston, Boston itself, and the various chronological periods in which individuals occupied the house. And I run our currently run our internship program, through which we have excellent, outstanding interns, especially one Alex Spice over the spring of 2020. And I conduct various programs that we offer throughout the year, including an annual lecture series in conjunction with the Lowell Institute. I also have supervisory duties on site at the house, as we are a public-facing institution and have traditionally done very high attendance. Last year, we did close to 300,000 people coming through the site in the course of the year, though obviously those numbers have been, which I'm sure we'll discuss a bit, greatly altered by the current pandemic. So I think that's, hopefully that's enough of an encapsulation of my background and what I do.
Yeah, great. Just what led you to choose museums and cultural heritage as sort of as your field?
Yeah, so I think I always have had a general interest in history. Growing up in rural Illinois, my family didn't travel a whole lot to different areas. We do an annual vacation up to northern Wisconsin, which is probably my favorite place in the world, but we didn't travel to many other varied sites. So I had an opportunity to travel abroad once in high school and very much enjoyed the experience. And then ultimately, as an undergrad, one of my cousins lived in Boston, so I traveled frequently or once a year to Boston while in undergrad. And it was through those experiences that I was really kind of blown away by the preservation, the history, the ability to use historic sites and engage with, you know, the public in various ways. So I added history as a secondary major, and I have viewed public history as somewhat of a fusion of my two great interests, which have been communication and broadcast communication with historical research. So I find public history to be a great balance of those two interests, and definitely for me, a more fulfilling way to convey information and interact with the public than strictly staying in academia as a professor writing content. In some cases, depending on how niche it is, that may only connect to, you know, 20s, 30s of people ever. And there's, I do think there's great significance in that as well for kind of the general human experience in documenting history, but I find public history a way in which you can work in the field and connect to so many more individuals than otherwise you might be able to.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. So let's sort of go back, I guess, to what was only, I guess, a few months ago, but still feels like forever ago. What was sort of, what do you remember about when the coronavirus first started entering the news cycle?
Yeah, I think it was, it was an interesting thing from a work standpoint, because we are such a public-facing institution and that we interact with so many people. I think it was on our radar from January and February, though it hadn't quite entered the United States yet. And I actually had done a trip in mid-February, which now with hindsight was actually pretty great timing that I was able to do a little bit of travel before everything shut down. But I was in Wisconsin just weeks before everything really went sideways. And my wife was traveling in Cleveland just after that. So I remember starting to get worried if she'd be able to make it back to Boston, which she was able to, you know, without problem. But that was just about the time things started to shut down in early March. So I remember, at least as an institution, having the sense that it was still pretty far away, and then as it became increasingly real that it, you know, there was this great uncertainty about the spread and how rapidly it could spread in that week of March that ended, I think we closed on March 12th. It seemed like it was just a rapidly developing week of anxiety, uncertainty. I remember writing the T and being very, the MBTA, the public transit system in Boston, and just being very worried about the proximity and the volume that was still on the trains. And I believe our last day that we were open as a site, just looking at the calendar, I think was March 12th. And I still remember that we were, you know, let's see, March 12th, that we still did about 250 people that day. So, I mean, it's still a lot. It was still, for the time, a lot of people going through. And then ultimately we made the decision that afternoon that we'd be closing to the public. At the time, I remember we put a sign up that said through March 31st, which obviously was naively optimistic and wasn't the case at all. But at the time we I think recognized that it was a grave, potentially grave situation, but still had no idea of what the timeline of it would be.
Absolutely. How did the decision to sort of close, how did that decision get made, I guess, in the case of the Revere House?
Yeah, so I think our executive director, Nina Zanieri, is really an exceptional leader in general in the field. And I think it was one of those things that really started to rapidly develop over the course of the day. I mean, I think we were still in the position that we were going to kind of, you know, see where things were moving and going. I recall too, I think we had a sense that we'd probably need to close at some point, but didn't know, you know, precisely when it would happen. And at least for me personally, I'm a big sports fan. So I think it was on March 11th. I remember watching some of the NBA games with the Dallas Mavericks in particular, and they announced mid game that the NBA season was canceled, which I think was the first big, like, whoa, this is getting very, very serious in terms of what's going to be open, closed, you know, what contours of life in America are going to look like soon. I think that was a big shocking moment for me, at least. And then the next day, as it progressed, it seemed like a lot of, as we were in conversations with, Nina was in conversations with a lot of our peers and partners, especially along the Freedom Trail and in Boston, it seemed like everyone was kind of rapidly coming to an accord that, that we would need to close for an unknown amount of time. So it was a decision that certainly, I mean, we operate as an individual institution, but from where we are in Boston, we have a lot of partner sites and a lot of peers in close proximity that have similar, you know, backgrounds and interests and functions. So I think it was one that we felt good to know that we had the support of other similar institutions that were making what was, you know, an unprecedented call. I remember Nina reflecting many times in that moment. It was still a very difficult decision to make, that, you know, we have never really closed as an institution before. The Paul Revere Memorial Association has existed for 112 years now. So even as is the case, I think with everywhere, nothing like this has really happened before. So it was still a very difficult decision to make that felt was heavy in the moment, but I think ultimately was one that was obviously the right decision in terms of concern for for public safety and staff safety, and one that was made a little bit easier in the fact that we were in lockstep with almost all of our peer sites in Boston.
Gotcha. What did, so as a full-time staff member, how did your job and your responsibilities sort of shift with the closing of the site?
Yeah, so we closed to the public that Thursday. So that would have been March 12th. We went into office the next day, which would have been the 13th, the senior staff members. I don't think all of us were in, but I was in the next day as we kind of went in, obviously did deep cleaning. We kind of plotted through the best we could what next steps were would be, and we set a rudimentary schedule for the coming weeks that we still needed to do building checks. We were still under the assumption that it would be safe to at least have a few of us in the office at a given time, but maybe not the full staff. So senior staff consists of 7 individuals in total. So I remember had a normal, insofar as you can say it, but a normal weekend that I was off on Saturday and Sunday, and then I was in on Monday with Nina, our executive director, and Alex, one of our program assistants. So the 3 of us were in that Monday to do building checks and had a normal day of work, obviously closed to the public, but we're typically closed on Mondays during the slower season. And we did our building checks, we did some desk work and things like that. And that was really the last time that we were in with multiple people until late June. So from that point, we went into a what became an increasingly reduced schedule of 2 people in separate buildings, maybe 3 days a week, and then ultimately, in terms of the physical work on site, it was 1 staff person. Ultimately, we got down to twice a week. I believe we're doing Mondays and Thursdays. So we still have 3 historic structures on site, buildings that date to 1680, 1711, and 1835 that have their own idiosyncrasies and concerns. So actually, I remember one day that I went in, it's useful that we were still doing building checks. This is early in the process. But I went in and the real temperature in our office building, which is a historic house, a Hitchborn house that dates to 1711, the real temperature on the first floor was at 90 degrees, which was not ideal at all. So we had to obviously do an emergency maintenance call, and guy from the HVAC company was able to come in and fix it. But that was obviously a very problematic situation. So we still had the need for those sorts of building checks. But after that, we got down to about once a week and then once every other week where we were going in. And ultimately, in terms of going into the office, it became kind of a fun experience because my wife would go in as well. She's working on a PhD and is a adjunct professor at Boston University. So we were able to go in. Obviously, we were connected in terms of our potential level of our actual level of quarantine and what we do as we live together. So she would go into the office and do her work while I would do building checks and get the mail and go to the bank or whatever we'd have to do institutionally. So that was my work on site. Otherwise, I feel like I stayed quite busy, and it allowed me to almost get back into the process of being a graduate student and doing a lot of the dissertation work that I would do from our apartment and from the kind of workspace that I have here. So it was nice to be able to get back in that sense to primary source research, continuing to work with yourself and Laura, the interns for 2020, and then in particular pivoting a lot of what we were doing institutionally to new digital content in the form of the Revere Express blog, which was still exists is a somewhat condensed version of the quarterly newsletter that we do, where we're writing new content pieces on various points of history connected to the Revere House or Boston, broadly construed, and somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 words. And then launching the Revere House radio podcast, which has actually been quite successful and something we'd considered for a while, but were able to utilize the opportunity of the shutdown and having more time off duty, so to speak, not time in the house working with the public. So we were able to use that distance time to produce that new content, which I really enjoyed as kind of a fusion of both my interest and background in radio and my work in history. So I think we were able to successfully harness some of the content that we've been kicking around and thinking of, and we're able to kind of rapidly get that up to speed and disseminate. And fortunately, we've been able to, since we've reopened now, keep that content going. And I think it's something as an institution that we're looking forward to continuing in the future at a reduced rate. We had kind of a high level of production initially, but now as our time is stretched a little bit differently now, we've scaled back the production, but are still continuing both of those through both of those sources.
Interesting. Awesome. In terms of just personally, how did you feel about sort of all of the rapid changes that sort of came as things shifted from, you know, not really things were open, but people didn't know until a sudden, like, I guess, onslaught of news about the coronavirus in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was definitely challenging. I feel like I, especially with the kind of the sports scene and mid, even in February, watching a lot of the European countries and where things are going, I think I had a little bit of a sense of maybe where things were going, not to any, you know, grand scale. So I think I somewhat processed a bit where the winds were blowing a little bit earlier. But then when things really started to shut down, I mean, it was definitely a shock and realizing that we would need to stay in and be as isolated as possible, I think was a challenge. But I think it's one that really I think Megan and I adapted to, you know, the best we could. I think it helps. And, you know, I know you recently had a lot of your work in graduate school as well. But I think it was, for us, being able to transition and back, at least for me, into that kind of moment of being a graduate student, in which I would kind of sit down at the workspace here and work, you know, from 9 to 5 or otherwise. So I think in terms of our actual, like, day-to-day work and function, I think it's something that we were able to actually kind of balance out and get into a groove, you know, relative terms, of course, but with some ease. So, you know, interacting in public and going to the grocery store, and I think especially early, just the touching of any surfaces and washing the hands, all of those things were, you know, causes of great stress, for sure. But I think we were able to kind of make the best of it as we could. And we did do one trip in early May to visit and stay with Megan's mother in Euclid, Ohio, just outside of Cleveland, for about a week. So we went straight there. We quarantined when we returned. So that was kind of a decision that had some stress attached to it initially, and then ultimately was totally fine. But it's something that we felt like we needed to do, and I think ultimately, you know, ended up being the, you know, the right thing to do as well.
Gotcha. In terms of, so obviously, I guess coronavirus hasn't been the only sort of big thing to happen in 2020. The killing of George Floyd and sort of protests related to that were equally sort of a big thing. And did that have any impact on sort of your job or your institution and what you were thinking about as all of that happened and continues to happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we had a lot of discussions in the moment around both around George Floyd, and then as protests really began to increase in Boston, I think and a lot of institutions did this. I think it felt like we needed to and desired to participate in that in a capacity that made sense to us. So it was something that I'd really sat with for some time, and I took the initiative actually to write an express post, which ultimately functioned as our kind of our statement for racial justice in the United States. But we wanted to make sure that what we were doing wasn't a blanket corporate statement or something without tangible value to it. So ultimately, I was able to write and then drafted or edited in conjunction with Nina and Emily Holmes and Adrienne Turnbull Riley a piece that also connects to one of the few primary sources that we have for Paul Revere, his contextual anti-slavery feelings in a kind of a terse exchange that he had with one of his former friends from Massachusetts, who was a transplant to the South. So I think institutionally we wanted to make sure we were being true to who we are and what our mission is in terms of the statement that we were able to put out. And I think it was fairly well received. But I think the important thing is that the work that we've been doing generally, and one of the things that I've really tried to push for in my time at the Revere House is to continue to make us and the stories that we tell broader than just Paul Revere and broader than really American history, and try to be true to what the site-specific history is, whether that be kind of points of first contact and Native American history in the 17th century, or unveiling the complicated stories of slavery and racial, you know, supremacy from the 17th into the 18th century and continuing within Boston itself, and generally telling more inclusive stories. I think that's something that we've worked for. That's something that we have continued and will continue to do so. So I think in some sense, while we do it in a small way, I think our work has stayed true to the point. So the moment didn't feel disingenuous, I think, to us to produce a statement like we did.
Great. So to transition more towards, I guess, reopening, could you talk a little bit about how you felt about going back to work personally, as well as, I guess, the decision-making around reopening as a museum in this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was one that we put a good deal of thought and work into. We had weeks of kind of training and getting the equipment that we needed, the PPE that we needed, and having the site set up the best we could for both staff safety and visitor safety. So a lot of thought and work went into it from all the senior staff. I think we all had reservations and trepidations about it, especially in the sense that once we did ultimately open, it was a lot of trial and errors. We did a soft opening a few weeks ago, so this would be now early or kind of mid July. But we worked within the state's limitations. We can have essentially seven people at a time on a floor in the house, so our numbers are drastically limited. But I think in terms of the spacing, in terms of the masks, I think those are all things that we are doing the best we can, and actually I feel generally faith in what we're doing. And I think importantly, definitionally, everything that we're doing really does not result in close contact anywhere, which would be within 6 feet and 15 minutes. We've set up the system in a way that no visitor should or does have close contact with any staff person at any point. So that's factoring in both staff safety and visitor safety. So I think no matter what, in this moment in time, everything does have inherent risk. I think everything's still uncertain. I think the numbers in the nation are generally not going the way they should, or we hope they maybe would be by August. But in terms of what we're doing institutionally, I think we're doing it as safely as possible. And I think that that's felt in both myself and the I can only speak for myself, but I think at least in terms of the senior staff, what we were able to put together over May, June, and early July.
Great. In terms of, you talked a little bit earlier sort of about having more time to focus on primary sources and sort of other projects when the site wasn't in operation. Has that sort of changed again now that the site is moving back towards, or is now accepting visitors again?
Yeah, I think it's been a matter of time, and I think that's something that we recognized would happen when we were doing these things. I think one of Nina's cautions was always make sure that we don't get into a situation in which we are not able to produce any content as soon as we reopen. So I was trying to strategically scale things back so we were able to continue putting out content through this reopen process. So while we were maybe doing three pieces a week at kind of the peak of the shutdown, we've now reduced to one piece a week, but is still, I think that's still meaningful at the moment. So definitely the time has shifted for me at work in terms of us being online, as it were, a lot more, working with the public and having to consider a lot more of the ramifications and daily operations than we had to. So the new project time that I had definitely has been decreased, but I think we've built in the structure and in a way that those projects can still continue. So they weren't one-off ventures or kind of specific ventures that would die off as we reopen. So I think we've done a good job of trying to find that work time balance.
Great. Looking towards something you mentioned there, I was wondering, as you've interacted more with visitors since returning to the site, what have those interactions been like overall?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was one I think that I had but definitely trepidation in initially, that we'd have pushback on visitors not wanting to wear masks, that we'd have pushback on visitors not wanting to do the mandated contact tracing, that we'd have visitors that were generally flippant about the whole scenario. And I have to say that really has not been the case at all, which has been really gratifying. I would say 95 to 98% of visitors have been totally compliant, have been very nice, have been on board with everything that we're doing. And I really thought that would be a much lower percentage. So that's been great to see. The only concern is where people are coming from. I'm asking, we don't require anyone, but just conversationally, I ask visitors, you know, where they're coming from. And we have had just so many visiting from parts of the country that are kind of going the wrong way, numbers-wise. So we've had a lot of Florida, we've had a lot from the South, et cetera. So that's definitely been a concern in thinking about where the numbers in Massachusetts have been. It hit hard early and then generally improved. Well, now we're seeing this influx in visitors from potentially problem areas. We'll see if the new directives from the governor, new travel restrictions that went into play on August 1st, we're speaking on August 4th, we'll see if those have any effect on where our visitors are coming from. But that's definitely the point of greatest concern since we've reopened.
Absolutely. Since since reopening, have you had more sort of local visitors than you would in a normal summer, or has that obviously the number of visitors is substantially mm-hmm. lower, and we can talk about that as well, but do you think there's been a greater proportion of local visitors, or do you think that has stayed about the same, just as people are maybe looking for something else to do or trying to go to things that they feel safe if they're open?
Yeah, I would say in my experience, and again, these are all anecdotally, I would say it's decreased. And in fact, I would say it's maybe decreased significantly. I really have not interacted with many local visitors, especially immediately local. I mean, we've had some from different parts of Massachusetts and New England, but I would say the vast majority that I have interacted with have been from different parts of the country. Our international travels, obviously, down to zero or about zero, I think. But I really think, and others might have different responses to this, but I think the local attendance has decreased, perhaps even significantly. Our numbers in general so far, with a couple of weeks under our belt, we're looking at about probably 10 to 15% of typical attendance this time of year.
Gotcha. And what would, how, in terms of just like number of people, what would a normal day during this time have looked like for the Revere House in your own experience?
Yeah, so I've only had 1 year under my belt, but typically definitely over 1,000. Generally this time, which would be our busiest year, usually looking at somewhere between 1,500 to 2,000 people, and even on some of the busiest, the very busiest days, we're doing over 2,000 individuals a day, so maybe 2,100. I think 2,200 was maybe the tops ever. Right now, especially just given how tours need to progress, both in time and space-wise, last week we were doing about 150 individuals a day, and then our busiest day, the last day that I worked, which was last Saturday, we did hit 200 exactly for the first time. So again, somewhere between that 10 to 15%, kind of as a moving target mark.
Gotcha. Sort of related to this, do you think there are specific or unique challenges that historic houses and other sort of historic sites versus a traditional museum are facing during this time?
Absolutely. It's all about space. I think it's just all about the space and the numbers and how you can get people into spaces safely and allow for distancing and allow for, you know, circulation and all of those things. I think that's our greatest challenge. And to some extent, actually, all of our numbers, I think, are somewhat reduced from what the demand would be, because we have had lines out and people have not wanted to wait the time to come in, because it just takes longer to get smaller numbers of individuals through the site in a safe manner, so everyone's distance, that their distance from themselves and distance from the staff members. So I think that's absolutely been our biggest challenge so far, relative to a large museum, say the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston or something to that extent, where you have a lot of built-in space. It's not something that we have, so we've had to reformulate kind of our tours that are more guided through stations rather than a typical self-guided experience for visitors that have come out. I think it's worked well so far, but that's definitely been the biggest challenge in trying to think creatively and in new ways about the very confined spaces that we just have existent, and there's no way you can change them without altering historic structures.
Absolutely, yeah. Speaking a little bit more broadly, I'm wondering, what do you think historic houses, or in general, or specific to the Paul Revere House and the related sites, what do you think they sort of offer us in this moment?
That's a good question. I think one of the things that we've talked about is they offer us a glimpse into lived experiences and previous moments of crisis, whether that be different pandemics, whether that be different outbreaks, whether that be wars, whether that be just kind of personal struggles and tragedies. So I think it's a way to connect to these very human experiences over different periods of time and put our moment into context. So I think that's important, and I think that's significant. I think they, well, so maybe for some moments of comfort and familiarity and visiting sites and periods of the past that some may, you know, connect to more than others. And I think for some, it allows for a diversionary experience in terms of general tourism and entertainment and the ability to experience fundamentally different views and spaces from daily life. So I think they can work in a few different ways. And I think especially in this moment of both the pandemic and increased, I think, reckoning in the nation, in the United States, for racial justice and awareness and being cognizant of a lot of the past wrongs and problems in the country, I think historic sites can and should be a touchstone for those questions too.
Fantastic. As part of sort of talking about what the Paul Revere House and other historic sites offer, I'm wondering specifically if you have any thoughts about how this will impact the Freedom Trail, but just because I feel like a big part of the Paul Revere House is its relationship to the Freedom Trail and the other sort of sites that exist on that trail.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a point of great concern, honestly. I think a lot of places, not just on the Freedom Trail, but historic sites in general, are going to be incredibly strapped to just simply survive and exist. I think we're seeing that in a lot of our partner institutions that are already making very tough decisions, financial decisions about what their staffing is going to look like, what their purpose is, how can they continue on. I think, fortunately, and a big credit to our executive director, Nino Zinier, I think we're in a, especially relative, very good financial position compared to a lot of our peers. That doesn't mean that we can't, you know, exist in perpetuity as things go on. But I think we're able to, we've kept all of our staff on through this entire process, which I think is quite unique in terms of, you know, relative to our peers. So I think there is a great concern about the continuation of a lot of our Freedom Trail partner sites, certainly concern for ourselves as well, but in terms of what these partnerships are going to look like and in terms of what sort of, you know, programming will continue to be available along the Freedom Trail. So I think things will probably look, and this is not, you know, prognosticated at all, but I think things will look different in one way or another in the coming year and coming years.
Great. That's very interesting to hear. Sorry, taking a moment to just check through everything I have so far. I guess, sort of now looking more towards the future, where do you see things going from here, just in terms of your own specific institution, how you see, assuming things, which admittedly there are no longer any safe assumptions, I feel like, in terms of the coronavirus, if things remain on this relatively same path, what do you see sort of going forward for your institution?
Yeah, I mean it's a tough question. I think we'll continue to. I think one of the opportunities has been able to produce this content, this new content that we've done that can be evergreen in some sense. So we'll have content and continue to produce content that can be used and returned to over in coming years, which I think is important given the uncertainty of the period on if we'd have to close down again, if our numbers will continue to be reduced, you know, those sorts of things. So I think we will anticipate very low visitation for a while coming up, especially before there's a vaccine, and then probably even after there's a vaccine, as people slowly return to the numbers. So, I mean, I think ideally we'd like to be able to get back to the numbers that we were doing, but I think that's probably unrealistic for some time. So it's finding a balance just in terms of survival about how to, you know, increase attendance in the best way that you can safely, while also trying to find different sources of revenue and monetize some of the products that and the good content that we are putting out. So I think it's, as is going to be the case with a lot of places, it's this hybridity of interacting with the public and spaces, but then also trying to harness and utilize this moment to interact with distance learning and digital content and maybe non-traditional spaces of visitation and places that we wouldn't be able to reach in normal times, and doing all of that within the capacity of our generally pretty small staff size.
Understood. Well, those are all of the questions I have. Is there anything else you wish I would have asked in relation to this oral history?
No, I think those cover a lot of it. Again, there's just stating the obvious, but a lot of uncertainty as to where things go as we're talking right now in this moment in early August. I think I think there's still a great deal of uncertainty as to whether Massachusetts will scale back the opening and the stages that we're in, if we'll continue on, you know, where the numbers for the rest of the country go and things like that. So all of it is so many cliches through this point, but we're really just trying to take it, you know, very slow and almost on a weekly basis to see where we're at, and we'll see where things go as the month and months progress.
Absolutely, yeah. Are there any closing thoughts you have about the importance of museums sort of in this moment, what they can offer to people?
Yeah, I think I covered a lot of my general thoughts. It's something that I think I need to ruminate on more going forward, but I think there is this moment of trying to consider where museums fit in and the stories museums are telling. And I think we're going to have, I think there will be a public reckoning in many ways as so many businesses see, you know, what their viability is moving forward. So I think these are big questions that, you know, I feel strongly about for a lot of places, but I think will continue to be answered, need to be answered in new ways by the general public in the coming months.
Fantastic. Well, thank you again for participating in this.
Of course. Yeah, my pleasure, Alex. This is great.
All right. Well, I'm just going to say thank you again, just because I really appreciate it. And I've really enjoyed sort of hearing your thoughts on all this, both your personal feelings as well as sort of how the institution has responded.
For sure. Absolutely. My pleasure.